This is an ABC podcast.
Clarence Adams was an American soldier in the Korean War when he became a prisoner of war. He was held captive for several years, and you would think once he was freed, he'd want to go home. You'd think wrong.
The war goes on for 3 years. It comes then to a kind of stalemate in 1953. There's a division of Korea, and there are thousands and thousands of POWs held on both sides. I mean, many of those POWs don't go back to North Korea or to China. They go elsewhere. But there are a group, more unexpectedly, of American POWs who choose to go in the other direction.
Clarence Adams is one of those men. Now, the thing to know about him is he's African-American, and he decides to move to China.
And he has been persuaded or influenced by the education he's received in the camps to think, actually, why would he go back to the US? He had come out of a history of racism. He was all too familiar with the brutality of the US, of his life in Memphis, and he's looking for a new life. And he's persuaded that communism offers something else, that this is a new start.
But this choice, unsurprisingly, causes a huge amount of concern and alarm in the States.
Because how could soldiers from the West really freely elect to choose that fate?
The answer, people come to believe, is they were brainwashed. You are listening to All in the Mind. I'm Sana Qadar. From the Korean War to the Cold War to current-day campaigns of misinformation, the threat of brainwashing has freaked people out across the decades. But where do you draw the line between what counts as brainwashing and what counts as influence? Are we all brainwashed to some degree just by virtue of living in a culture?
I mean, none of us are self-made in terms of our minds and our identities. So there would be a fantasy of a sort of self-made person who's never ventriloquizing someone else.
Daniel Pick is a psychoanalyst, historian, and author of Brainwashed, A New History of Thought Control. So today, we look at the origins, methods, and variations of brainwashing. So on the term of brainwashing, like it's such an evocative and vivid term. Can you explain where the term came from?
Well, interestingly, the term is coined in 1950, and it comes up on both sides of the Atlantic. And the person who's credited with popularizing it in 1950 is Edward Hunter, who was a journalist who had worked in wartime intelligence. He wrote an article naming this new idea of brainwashing, which was meant to be a translation of a Chinese term for the cleansing of the mind. And he was warning his readers about Maoism and communism and this idea that a new set of techniques had emerged that could be used to manipulate the minds of the masses. And so it was part of that early Cold War fear of communism and particularly of what was going on in China and this idea of thought reform or thought control and how insidious and dangerous this could be. He was not the only one. There were then a whole spate of articles and books and films in which this term became a kind of political football.
And so was that early panic and introduction to it really focused on China?
Well, I think, again, there's the backdrop of all the post-war interest in denazification. So one also has to sort of think this is only a few years after the end of the Second World War and the question of how to denazify Germans and how to restore a liberal democracy, how to create and fashion subjects. But there was also the anxieties about communism in Russia, the Soviet Union, this idea of a sort of contagious set of ideas that were, you know, going to take over the people and also be infiltrated into the West. But then, of course, with this, the creation of the People's Republic in China with Mao got a new context. And this idea that there, you know, that sort of whole swathes of the globe now are under communist, under the sort of hammer and sickle, the question of whether there was going to be a sort of domino effect of other countries becoming part of this communist empire. So I think initially there was a sort of Orientalist fascination, you know, and sort of sense of disturbance about the East, about China.
given this atmosphere, it's no wonder Clarence Adams' decision caused so much drama. Remember, he chose to move to Mao's China after being freed as a POW in the Korean War. He tapped into the US's worst fears about brainwashing.
He's very turned off by the pressure to return to the US and really by the ideology of anti-communism in the US, but this kind of shrill atmosphere, which of course we know now as McCarthyism, in which there's a kind of total hostility to left-wing thinking and witch hunts and all the rest of it. And he chooses to go to have this adventure, which lasts for a number of years. He marries a Chinese woman. He has two children.
But Clarence's story doesn't end in China.
As conditions become more difficult for Western citizens, he and a number of the others change their mind and go back to the US. And he has a very hard time when he goes back, but he survives. He's not ultimately court-martialed or jailed or anything else, but he's put through the ringer by the FBI and is quizzed and so on.
Later, he writes a memoir, An American Dream, reflecting on this period in his life. But Clarence wasn't the only American soldier to choose to live in China and then later change their mind and head home.
A number of the others of those POWs also who changed their minds also reflect on it later. And in the book, I try to tell, you know, give vignettes about Adams and some of the others, including David Hawkins, who was the youngest of that group of 21, who was a white boy from Oklahoma, very young, 17 when he joined up. He again feels he doesn't have much to go back to the US for. But he is very puzzled about this label brainwashing. He goes back to the US and is interviewed on television, in which the question is, were you brainwashed? You know, you're either a traitor and a turncoat, or you were brainwashed. How do we know that you weren't brainwashed? And Hawkins is very quite cool about this and says, well, you wouldn't know. There's a very interesting interchange in which the assumption of the interviewer is, you were either a monstrous traitor or you were a brainwashed stooge.
In terms of what brainwashing is it actually effective, or is the fascination and fear with this term more based on like the fear of its potential impact?
I think in the Cold War, it's often melodramatized. So I think we have to be cautious and to see the way in which it was loaded with assumptions and sensationalism. However, I think that, you know, if you take people prisoner, if you deprive them of all forms of access to other news, you traumatize people, you torture people physically and mentally, you all sorts of techniques in the 50s on both sides that are used: sensory deprivation, stress positions, squalid conditions, noise, silence, isolation. I mean, you can do terrible things to the mind. So I don't think that's really in doubt. And this, in a way, part of what horrifies people in the 50s is the capacity to destroy. You know, the sense that people are fragile, that identity is precarious. And then once you've broken people, then the question is, what can you do with this kind of hollowed out shell of a person, you know, where you've humiliated, induced guilt, I mean, all the sort of techniques that are being written about.
So that is the playbook for brainwashing then. It's quite violent.
It can be very violent. It can involve groups, group pressures, you know, as well as also people's desperation to be loved or to find contact. So if you isolate people and have a very hateful, cruel interrogator, and then you introduce a sort of kind, apparently kindly figure, people's desperation to find someone to cling on to or to trust. So all kinds of techniques, more or less, in a way, overtly violent, were developed in that period.
Daniel says when you scale up and look at how cults or certain political regimes try to control what and how people think, there are a lot of similarities.
One of the kind of characters who I celebrate in the book, he's still alive, he's a psychiatrist and historian writer, is Robert J. Lifton, who wrote a really influential book on this subject in 1961. So in that book, he thinks about sort of more structurally, what kind of ways do cults or political states operate in order to close down opportunities for dissent, for debate, for fact-checking? You know, very often in these so-called brainwashing regimes, that you control the exit doors. Nobody can get out. other forms of information are controlled, limited, or sometimes completely eliminated. You have purification rituals, you have a culture of confession, and so on. So he's suggesting some of the techniques that you say might run across different forms of cult, organization, or even state that make it much harder for people to think. And just to take one other key philosopher in that period who's thinking very hard about related questions is Hannah Arendt. And she suggests that there are certain forms of political state that she thinks of as totalitarian, in which news and information is organized in such a way, not necessarily to convince everyone, you know, of X or Y, but completely to destroy any way of knowing what's true and what's false. So a kind of total assault on that capacity to discern, and where people sort of in a way become totally disorientated, and which lying and truth-telling are sort of in a way blurred, and you lose all sense.
Was she talking about our current point in time? Oh my goodness.
It's terribly relevant. I mean, with a lot of these writers, I think the best writers of that period, they are very timely for the age of fake news, of, you know, all our fears, Cambridge Analytica, Facebook, what's happening on the internet, authoritarian populism, and people in news silos.
Yeah.
So, of course, these speak also to our very different times as well.
This is All in the Mind. I'm Sana Qadar. Today, the history of thought control and brainwashing with psychoanalyst and author Daniel Pick. Let's return to the 1950s now, the heyday of panic about brainwashing. The West at this time was obsessed with China and the Soviet Union and communism in general, and how its citizens might be corrupted. I mean, did it occur to anyone in the West that this was something that could be done by the US or the UK themselves? Like, you know, brainwashing wasn't just a thing that was some scary technique from the East. It was very well applicable to them as well.
I think that's right. And I think the concept does sort of quite soon boomerang back on the West, you know, into sort of debates about persuasion and hidden influence in the West. And of course, long before this debate about brainwashing has emerged, there'd been a lot of discussion in the West about what was going on in European countries and in the United States and other parts of the world about sort of mass suggestion and group phenomena. So in that sense, it wasn't new to hold a mirror up to our societies. You know, so there's all that backdrop that you get with, in the late 19th century, really the invention of crowd psychology, of thinking about in an age where the masses have become political actors and you've got, you know, ever more people voting, mass media. But then, yeah, in the 1950s, after the term brainwashing has been coined and there's this initial focus on China, there's a lot of discussion then about how far this might apply in conditions of relative freedom.
Other terms began entering the mix around this time as well. Phrases that alluded to this kind of thought control or thought influence.
Alongside that more dramatic term, brainwashing, you have other terms like groupthink. Mm. That's coined in 1952 by an American business journalist, William White, writing actually in a business magazine, suggesting that it's not brainwashing in this sort of melodramatic sense of a sort of total takeover by some insidious power. He's more suggesting that in corporations, in big business, in huge bureaucracies in the United States, there's a sort of curious synchronization of behavior and opinion occurring, where people just start becoming more alike in their attitudes, in their mores, their customs. And he's interested in how does this kind of get inculcated so that people are selected for jobs because they are like other people, they fit in, and how people then adapt and acclimatize to the culture of big business.
And soon the advertising industry picks up on the fact that you can really influence people's behavior by influencing their minds. Two characters help tell the story of influence through advertising in this era, psychologist Ernest Dichter and journalist Vance Packard. First, psychologist Ernest Dichter.
After the war, Dichter is very important, sets up an institute for what he calls motivational research in New York State. And this is offered as a service to the advertising industry, in which Dichter promises them that you can, in a way, plumb the depths of people's minds. Instead of just thinking about what products actually are offering directly, you need to sort of drill down into what people secretly think about products and what their emotional associations are, or the unconscious meanings. And you need, he says, focus groups. You need to sort of explore in depth this, as it were, psychological attitudes to consumption. And he develops this whole sort of technique about fashioning products in accordance with what he thinks of as the deeper desires and appetites and anxieties of the masses, and has a very successful career.
But then in the late 1950s, along comes journalist Vance Packard, who publishes a book that lifts the lid on these techniques in the ad world. It's called The Hidden Persuaders.
Packard becomes a bestseller, and it's about Madison Avenue. This idea of the advertising industry is harnessing these techniques, ideas about behaviorism, ideas about the unconscious, and using it in ever more sophisticated ways to sell people goods or political ideas that make, you know, a mockery of the idea of either political voters or consumers really freely choosing for themselves. Packard tries to expose these techniques and to warn the reader that they are, in a way, being used and manipulated and nudged to consume things for reasons they're not consciously aware of.
In 1957, the year The Hidden Persuaders is published, Packard and Dichter go on radio and debate the merits of all of this.
Dichter says, you know, it's all overblown, he's sensationalizing it. What's wrong with giving people information about products? And on the other hand, Dichter is saying this is as old as, you know, humankind, that there's always been persuasion and it begins in family. So why is he picking on the advertising industry? Whereas Packard thinks it's really very dangerous and sees where it's going, you know, that new forms of both surveillance and manipulation. But advertising, you know, becomes really, I think, the kind of key area in the West where you see these debates about mind control really becoming powerful and influential by the late 1950s.
In terms of this constellation of terms, is it fair to sort of describe it as brainwashing is like a continuum of behavior where perhaps, you know, on one end of the spectrum you have brainwashing, the other end persuasion, in the middle there's groupthink, manipulation, all these sorts of other things?
Yes, and, you know, and one can then run that spectrum onto training and drilling in armies and think about education itself. And at what point does education start to blur into something called drilling or training and then into something called groupthink? You know, not suggesting that there's some sinister conspiracy to do this, but just that these sort of processes can lead to a world in which people aren't actually able to think. I mean, one of the things that really interested me in doing the research for the book and then in trying to sort of think about this is how this whole language of mind control that crystallizes in the 1950s was a kind of invitation to people to worry about their own minds, even if they weren't in, you know, prisoners or prisoners of war or prisoners of conscience or in a kind of totalitarian state. But the question of brainwashing or groupthink posed the question, what is it to think for yourself? How do you know that your thoughts are your own, that your identity is in some way authentic and not being sort of somehow manipulated and fashioned? And there is a spectrum, and we're all in a way influenced in myriad ways by other people, by teachers, by culture, all sorts of things. So I think the spectrum is what's at stake. And one person's brainwasher might be another person's freedom fighter. So all these terms are up for grabs.
The anxiety around the threat of brainwashing and techniques of persuasion remained elevated through the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So much so that, at one point, even the Beatles are accused of brainwashing young people. Just going back to the wartime techniques, the violence we talked about, I'm curious how we got from that sort of description of brainwashing to when the Beatles were accused of brainwashing. How did that term travel so far from war and violence to, you know, now being applied to a musical group?
I mean, I think, again, you know, there's a bigger history which is about soft power in the world, and there's overt propaganda. And of course, in the world wars propaganda becomes a kind of key thing when you're thinking about morale in warfare. But the question of soft power and culture and the way in which a culture, popular culture, can also shape and influence people, whether it's cartoons, whether it's pulp fiction, or whether it's popular music. So there's quite a lot of anxiety as pop music really takes off with Elvis, or later the Beatles, about mass hysteria. And this kind of sense of something so excited and out of control and suggestible that's going on. And then, you know, with some of the Beatles' more experimental music, they're more challenging and radical songs. Right-wing pastors and politicians in the US start to sort of turn on them, particularly when the Beatles are touring in the US, and sort of warn against both the sort of sexual decadence, licentiousness, you know, all that sort of sense of permissiveness, and the idea that they might be in some way in the service of communism.
Whether the Beatles were actually trying to brainwash anyone through their music is doubtful, but one group that did know the power of music and art to spread a message was the CIA.
Yes, I mean, that soft power is used so that jazz musicians were seen as kind of helpful for the Western case, influencing people in under communism about, you know, jazz as a form of improvisation, because it's not all scripted. So the idea of the art of freedom of artists like Jackson Pollock, with his amazing techniques of painting that are sort of all about liberation and the unconscious and some kind of experimentalism, is also seen as useful in this kind of Cold War struggle. So both sides used overtly and covertly culture, science, music to advance their course. Film as well, you know, becomes part of this sort of battle of ideas, you know, not just in the US and the Soviet Union, but the sense that the whole world is now kind of a cultural and political battleground for this idea of sort of psychological warfare.
But what did the CIA actually do with sort of jazz musicians and Jackson Pollock? Did they, you know, sort of take them abroad, or?
They promoted them, and there's a really interesting book called Who Paid the Piper that tells the story of all the covert funding. So there was an awful lot, you know, that was later uncovered about this sort of soft power issue in the West. And the Beatles were accused on both sides, because they were also seen, you know, it caused unease in the Soviet Union for corrupting Soviet young people. So it wasn't just in the West. So, and I should also mention Elvis Presley, because he earlier has aroused all this anxiety about sort of sexual, you know, a sort of more orgiastic kind of audience reaction to his, you know, his body, his rhythm, his swiveling hips and all, you know, his sound. But he presents himself later on, turns up at the White House at the end of the 1960s to meet Richard Nixon, and wants to be sworn in as a special agent. So Nixon agrees to meet him. I mean, he literally just turns up in his car and with a letter for Nixon, and Nixon then invites him in, and Presley wants to be at this point a special agent to deal with, quote, the brainwashing, quote, of American youth. So he sort of has some idea that he could be a sort of antidote. He doesn't specify the Beatles or any other group, but he has some idea of a kind of, you know, manipulation and malaise in American young people, and he's sort of somehow going to be a helpful agent of the state.
And was he used by them?
I don't think so. I think Nixon was bemused. He was told he ought to see Presley because this would be good. And there's a photograph of the two of them meeting, and Presley is given some kind of certificate. So I think it's sort of humouring Presley, but Nixon's also a bit, you know, kind of like wondering what's going on. But he's advised he ought to meet, and there's this kind of curious encounter, which I think is one of the more whimsical moments. So there is a sort of more lighthearted element to the story of brainwashing. Yeah. But I suppose one also has to keep in mind that this is a story that can be both taken up in popular culture, but also is in a way a hideous story in which people actually suffer, prisoners, you know, and all the rest of it.
Yes.
So I think it's a complex story that goes from the world of cartoons through to the horror of detention and torture.
I want to come to today. What are the most troubling examples of brainwashing that we see going on today, do you think?
I mean, again, you know, you'll get different answers from different commentators, journalists, politicians, depending on their political orientation. And I'm coming, you know, in a way from the liberal position and the left position rather than a right wing position where, you know, you might get a very different answer to where that's coming from. But I think that climate change denial, I think authoritarian populism, I think, you know, there are all kinds of ways in which we are manipulated. Of course, one might see liberalism as itself very complacent. But I think today, you know, I think the very obvious dangers, one thinks of Bolsonaro, one thinks of Trump, one thinks of all kinds of new neo-fascist forces where even the most basic claims about facts are in contention. I think, you know, we are in a very different world where we can't agree. Like in the United States, that there isn't a consensus even about the most elementary facts, like the size of a crowd in the inauguration of a president. The president says it's the biggest crowd ever, and the photographs appear to show otherwise. And even that can be contentious. And of course, the internet, in some ways, that's such a tool for information and education. And it's not that the internet is all bad, but one can also see how that has played into some of this in insidious ways, you know, and I'm just in a way saying obvious things here about news silos and echo chambers online and the way in which this can also be manipulated and gamed, even on search engines, so as to what you find and so on. I mean, there are new terms we have now that are also to be treated with caution, like radicalization and de-radicalization, that are maybe the heirs to this language of brainwashing. But I suppose what I'm arguing in the book is that there's a rich literature from the past. It doesn't deal with all our problems, of course, but nonetheless a very rich literature that we can return to and sort of think about how that might help us to think about the conditions we're facing, the crisis we're in now.
And finally, we've talked about so many different examples, the spectrum from violent brainwashing to persuasion and all the rest. Are we all brainwashed to a degree just by virtue of living in a culture, just by virtue of living in structures of power? You know, like, can we ever escape this, really?
I mean, none of us are self-made in terms of our minds and our identities. So there would be a fantasy of a sort of self-made person who's never ventriloquizing someone else, who's never identified unconsciously with someone else. I mean, it's fundamental to the human condition, isn't it? I mean, to think about how as babies, as infants, as children, we're shaped by our primary carers, by our peers, by whether it's siblings, family, school, culture, all the rest of it. So it would be fantastical to imagine ourselves as immune to that. So the question is not whether one could be completely exempted from all of this, but to think about, you know, the forms that are more helpful, benign, open to scrutiny. And that's true, of course, with education, with universities, with media, with cinema, you know, that it can be more or less open to exploration, to helping people sometimes to doubt and to question presuppositions rather than to manipulate and reinforce ideological assumptions.
That's it for All in the Mind. Thanks to Daniel Pick, psychoanalyst, historian, and author of Brainwashed, A New History of Thought Control. Thanks also to producer Rose Kerr and sound engineer John Jacobs. I'm Sana Qadar. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.